Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining this medcast entitled Exploring Oral Systemic Therapies for Plaque Psoriasis, Looking at Efficacy, Safety, and Clinical Considerations. I am Lauren Miller. I'm a dermatology PA practicing in Oxford, Alabama at Southern Skies Dermatology and Surgery. I've been in dermatology for around 16 years. Love it. Can't imagine doing anything else. Today, I'm joined by my faithful sidekick who has done several of these now with me, Jamie Heim. Jamie, thank you for doing another one with me.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm Jamie Heim, and I'm a nurse practitioner, and I practice at West Michigan Dermatology, which is in Granville, Michigan.
And you've been practicing for how long?
Oh, about 2 decades.
Yeah, yeah,
Just
yeah.
a little while. Yes,
Yep.
absolutely. And
So
I really enjoy it.
you have a wealth of knowledge, just in for dermatology in general, but for definitely inflammatory skin diseases. I've always looked to you, as an expert among the APPs. So thank you for being my sidekick for these. And we are going to discuss today, some exciting new developments in the treatment landscape of plaque psoriasis. So it's been a while, but we finally have had a boom of therapies for plaque psoriasis, and we've got some novel ones. So not duplicates of things and just kind of tweaking a little something, something. We've actually got brand new novel therapies, novel topicals, novel oral therapies. And so that's helped us be able to provide our patients with other options, more options to be able to get them better outcomes. So every time we do these med cast, we have a guest and we have one of my favorites who I've known for a long
Oh.
time and also look at as an expert, Kirk Gaudier, which I love that last name. It's so fancy.
Hi,
So,
how
Kirk,
are you? How's
introduce.
everybody doing tonight?
Good. So
Hi,
introduce
my
yourself.
name is Kirk Gaudier. Yes, I'm a PA in dermatology for I think 21 years now at a single specialty clinic here in East Texas, about 2 hours east of Dallas, about 2 hours west of Shreveport. We are a very large medical hub and getting a brand new medical school and looking forward to training our own residents. It's gonna be a great thing coming up. So we do a lot of psoriasis, a lot of systemic disease, a lot of cancer in my clinic, and 5 days a week just 50 patients a day typically, and it's a busy time.
Oh, that makes me sweat thinking about it, Kirk. And so
Me too.
when did you start practicing? When you were 10? You don't look old enough
No,
to have been doing this for 21
wrong.
years. So, I mean,
That's
I'm just
really sweet.
saying,
I think I was in my 20s. I think I was.
All righty. Well, Kirk, we've done several of these sessions, and there has been a common theme that we have had across all of them. We've talked about defining moderate disease and whether or not that's something that's still relative or if we're kind of getting away from that. And we've also talked about obviously these novel therapies that are on the market. How do we explain them to patients? How do we explain them to our colleagues who maybe are a little bit shy when it comes to using some new therapies when they first come out? So let's just kind of start off. I'd love to hear your take on what you look at as, moderate. Do you use the, clinical guidelines, or do you take into account other things that you see with the patient or that you ask the patient? Or do you just kind of throw all that to the wind and say, I'm going to just do, whatever I think is best for that particular patient, depending on what their preferences, do they want a pill, do they want an injection, what have they tried in the past? Walk me through how you decide and what you use to decide what you're going to do for treatment.
It is going to be very individualized based on the patient's history, and not only the history of their disease, but also their history with me. And let me preface that by saying just today I had somebody who I have had on multiple biologics He starts and he quits. He starts and he quits. And he came back in today, and I haven't seen him for 5 years. And I gave him a topical, and I gave him a topical PDE4 inhibitor. He has psoriasis on his face and neck and genitalia. And I won't, you know, I'm going to treat him that way because he is not somebody who is consistent with his medication. And I don't feel like playing that game. Now, then I'll have other people that come in that are very consistent with their appointments and follow-ups and their labs and everything that we need to do. And man, I will bend over backwards for these people to get them every kind of therapy that I can possibly get them that's going to make their quality of life better. Now, that might make me sound kind of mean or crass. I gave the gentleman a very appropriate therapy. He had, you know, less than 3% body surface area, and I gave him a medication that is extremely safe to use on all of the locations that he has. It just might be a little bit slower than some of the other biologics that are out there. But then you look at a, you know, younger patient, a pediatric patient, and I will be very aggressive getting them clear so they don't develop any kind of stigmata about their particular condition, that doesn't become a part of their personality and a part of their life as they're growing up and developing. So I, you know, classically we think, okay, 10% of body surface area is moderate, or if it's in sensitive areas like the hands, feet, face, genitalia, or scalp, or if they fail topical therapy, if that's not able to control their symptoms, then we move on to some kind of a systemic medication, whether it's oral or an injectable biologic. But it's very individualized for my patients.
Yeah. And I love that you said that you are aggressive with your pediatric patients. I'm prepping for a conference and a lecture, and we previously have talked about the psychosocial impact of these inflammatory skin diseases, and especially with plaque psoriasis. Studies have shown that these pediatric patients have the highest risk of depression. And so I love that you are aggressive with them from the beginning. Obviously, because of the stigma that comes along with their disease, but because of the comorbidities like depression that also come with the disease as well. So I think that's great. So we know that we now have two systemic therapies that are probably, I'd say probably gold standard, at least I think so. I don't use a lot of methotrexate unless I have to. If I have a patient that has been on methotrexate for a really long time and it's worked for them and they want to stay on it and they've come from somewhere else, then yes. Or if for some reason an insurance just requires it, then I will. But I feel like we finally have some other oral options that are superior in efficacy, better safety profile. And so I really just don't use it. So I kind of look at the two therapies that we are going to go to most often as apremilast, and now we have deucravacitinib. And it was a long time between apremilast and deucravacitinib. But let's take those two, Kirk, and let's just pretend that you have a patient that you know you're going to do systemic therapy with. How do you go about deciding between apremilast or deucravacitinib?
So, I don't find any reason currently to write apremilast at all. Apremilast is an oral PDE4 inhibitor that you have to up titrate. It's given twice a day. There is an older version of an oral PDE4 inhibitor that I have found to be just as efficacious. And it is available for $20 for a 3 month supply from excuse me, from Mark Cuban's pharmacy up in Ohio. So with that knowledge, I don't see a reason to write that particular medication at all. Now, as far as efficacy goes, the newer medication, deucravacitinib, which is just a fantastic story in of itself, is almost twice as efficacious as apremilast, and most likely almost twice as efficacious as this other older PDE4 inhibitor that is on the market. So If I am considering an oral option for my patients, if it, the deucravacitinib is much more forefront in my mind to think about it, especially thinking about some areas that clear up a lot better, particularly the scalp or the palms of soles and hands. This particular medication, which is a TYK2 inhibitor, member of the Janus kinase family, really does a good job in punching it out, even with some biologics in these particular areas as far as efficacy goes.
And Jamie, when we talk about the two drugs, we know that deucravacitinib went head to head against apremilast. And would you use that comparative data to help you decide which one you might use?
Well, that's a whole different question for me, just because of the fact that, like you said, we've had apremilast for a while. I have patients that are still on apremilast who know that, there are some patients really have a difficult time with titrating that dose up and getting to 30/30 twice a day. They also have a hard time with side effect of medication, such as a flatulence, or they'll have nauseousness or diarrhea. And some people have headache, but there are some people who tolerate it really, really well that are still on it for their hands and their feet and for their scalp. And it truly it amazes me. It really does. And they've done so incredibly well. And I think that that's why we can't eliminate any of the medications that we have. But as far as just overall general tolerability. So if I'm going to look at multiple patients and say, who's going to, and I know that there are patients that are not going to tolerate apremilast. I know that there are going to be slower titrations and everything. It's going to be slower to get to that. But the definitely deucravacitinib, that medication itself is more efficacious. Also, it's tolerated very well right off the bat because it's 6 milligrams once a day dosing. I don't have to worry about whether they're eating a fatty meal with it or they're not eating a fatty meal with it or they're drinking a cup of coffee with it. I don't have to worry about which medications that they're on. Where with apremilast, I have to think about are they on an anticonvulsive medication? So it just, there are certain things that I have to consider more when I'm looking at apremilast versus deucravacitinib. And so when I look at that overall and looking at the tolerability, the safety, and efficacy, if I'm just looking at strictly at clinical data, when I have a head-to-head right in front of me, I can absolutely see that just like Kurt had mentioned before, in deucravacitinib, it's about 2 times more in regards to its efficacy in those results. Not only looking at week 16 data, but looking at week 24 data. And out into 52 weeks. So that clearly shows me right there in that data that it is definitely more efficacious.
I think one of the things for me, I'm like you, I have some apremilast patients that are doing amazing, and I would never take them off because they're stable and they're happy. They were some of the ones that didn't get any of the GI issues. So of course, we're going to just stick with what we're doing. I think for me, when deucravacitinib launched, I was really excited to just to see if we were going to have an option that was a little bit more consistent because you just never knew or still don't know with apremilast. Okay, are they going to respond or are they not going to respond? The really cons the consistency has been something that I've had trouble with. But I always love a good head-to-head comparator, especially I think too for some of the newer PAs and NPs that are in dermatology that are trying to figure out, okay, what drug do I use? It's always nice to have something where you can look at which one was more efficacious, which one was safer or more tolerable. And so I always like to see those. So when we talk about deucravacitinib, we have to obviously talk about its mechanism of action. And Kirk, you already alluded to this. We've got this shift now. We've started talking about the JAK-STAT pathway, which is something that, even a year to 2 years ago, we really weren't even talking about. And now, if we're going to prescribe these drugs, we have to understand the JAK-STAT pathway, which includes what TYK2 is and what JAK inhibitors are. There's lots of ways that we're using these JAK inhibitors now, not just for plaque psoriasis, but even for, other disease states. But there is a big difference between a TYK2 inhibitor and a JAK inhibitor. So, Kirk, show me your expertise and how you would explain the difference between a TYK2 inhibitor and a JAK inhibitor.
Well, there's over 500 different kinases in the body, okay? And a kinase just means by definition that it uses a phosphorus to exert its enzymatic activity, that it needs to have a phosphorus. Of the four that are in the Janus kinase family, okay, they are 48% similar, meaning they are 52% dissimilar. There's seven domains in a particular JAK inhibitor. There's three on the outside of the cell, or two transition, and two on the inside of the cell that are basically there to transmit information from the cytokines in the bloodstream and the system to the cells in our body. And interestingly enough, the main differences that we find in the Janus kinase and family is the little three parts on the outside that are grabbing cytokines. And I always tell a story. I'm like, have you ever played the claw game, right? It's really hard to grab that little prize that you want. However, if you had two claws, you could grab the little prize that you want. So the way these Janus kinase inhibitors work, or these, excuse me, the way the Janus kinase family works, is to relay message from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell by using these little bitty claws, but they pair together to make it easier to grab any of the cytokines that are swimming around outside of our cells. And when they do pair together, then they come together and they need a phosphorus. They need a phosphorus from ATP, from adenosine triphosphate, to exert this enzymatic activity and recruit what's called a signal transducer and activator of transcription, basically a messenger to the nucleus of the cell. So we've got a chemical messenger floating around. It's kind of getting touched by these different Janus kinases. They grab it, they come together, they recruit a messenger that goes down to the nucleus of the cell and tells the cells what to do, what other kind of enzymatic activities to produce, what kind of proteins to start spitting out. The way all of the current Janus kinase inhibitors work, the JAK inhibitors work, is on one side of the inside of the cell. Remember I said there was seven parts, three on the outside, two in the middle, and two on the inside. The two on the inside are different, at least on one half. On one half of them, it's what's called a pseudokinase, or regulatory domain. Other side is the active or the ATP, where that phosphorus comes in and gives the energy to get them to recruit the signal, the signal trans tr oh the signal transmitter. That pretty much looks all the same, but this one side looks completely different. What I like to think of it is, if you have a car, right? You can go and fill your car up with the energy, the gas, from almost any gas tank. Even the electronic vehicles, their insert looks very similar. That's this active binding domain on the inside of the cell. Now, the other side is like your key. Your key is very specific for your car, and it's only going to unlock or lock, start your car. The way deucravacitinib works is on this side, and it is the only FDA-approved molecule right now to work in the Janus kinase family on this regulatory or pseudokinase domain, and it is different between all the four Janus kinases that are in our body. Okay, so it's not the same medication; it works completely different, and that's why it avoided the black box warning that the FDA provided for every single Janus kinase that treats an inflammatory condition. So it's a different medication. It only works basically on immune systems, on your immune system, because the cytokine, remember, on that go on the outside of the cell, what it's trying to do, that information that's floating around, there are just three different cytokines that work on this one particular pathway. IL-23, which we all know is very important in the psoriasis pathway, IL-12, and then type 1 interferon, which is going to be something awesome that's going to come up later in the future. But if we can stop IL-23 from turning on these little naive thymus cells or Th17 cells, we can stop the production of IL-17. And we know IL-17 also, right? We can inhibit IL-23, we can stop psoriasis. If we can inhibit IL-17, we can stop psoriasis. So this basically, deucravacitinib, is a it's breaking the link in that chain. So IL-23 can't turn on and make IL-17. Long-winded explanation, but the science is really, really cool, and I can nerd out about it all day long.
It is. I said that in a previous session. I have a chemistry and biology degree, and everybody thought I was crazy to double major. And I was just like, I can't help it. I love the science part of it. So I geek out too, Kirk. So it's okay.
Sorry.
But and Jamie and I've talked in previous sessions about obviously TYK2 inhibition, and there's definitely some pros, I think, to JAK inhibition. We know that they work really, really fast. They're very effective. We are using them for multiple disease states. But TYK2 obviously has definite pros that come along with it. We've talked about the short half-life, which can be very beneficial. We talked about how selective it is, so we don't really have that collateral damage that you kind of mentioned. It only really works on immune function. So lots of pros. Let's talk about deucravacitinib's pivotal trials. So we know their pivotal trials. They had POETYK PSO1, POETYK PSO2. They have 3-year safety data, but they're about to release 4-year safety data, and I'm really excited for that. But Jamie, can you touch on some of the results that they saw in their pivotal trials?
Well, one of the things that they saw is that they did not see any additional safety signals. So when we look at the long-term extension and they had out to 4 years, everything was consistent. And so we did not see that long-term, that safety data remained consistent. And that's really important because we want to know that when medication comes out, we look at the trials that have been done. But what's going to happen later on down the line? I think that that brings us all a lot of comfort in prescribing. When we look at just the, as far as for the medication itself, very low incidence of discontinuation, very low discontinuation. The very low incidence of also infection seen with this medication. And when we looked at even like the safety in as far as the side effects, definitely very low in regards to nauseousness, vomiting, headache, all those types of things. And so it was there in the trials.
Yeah, I think having that 3-year safety data and now coming up with the 4-year safety data, we want to be able to give efficacious medicine, but not if it means that we have to take safety away. We have to sacrifice safety, then it's not worth it. So being able to have a drug that we have found to be efficacious, but it's safe as well, and with increased exposure to medication, we're not seeing any new safety signals. And not only is it maintaining its efficacy, but it's maintaining its safety. Obviously, it's kind of a win-win. So, Kirk, have you had some experience? Obviously, I know you have with deucravacitinib. Do you have a particular like patient story, or maybe you're like, eh, I wonder if this is going to work or not in this patient, and you were kind of surprised, or maybe surprised that it didn't work? Any patient story you want to share?
I always go back to one of my favorite patients. He's a guy who If I see him, I need to schedule for like 30 minutes because we can sit there and just talk. And he just has so many stories. Anyhow, I was treating his seborrheic dermatitis on his scalp. And I really wasn't doing a very good job of it. I was injecting with intralesional Kenalog. I was giving the topical clobetasol. I think I had the shampoo we were using. And it went on for like maybe close to 2 years, seeing him every 6 months, trying a little bit of variation. And then one day he came in and he said, "You know, I just got some new cats. And every place that their claw hits me on my arm, they're leaving me some weird little red mark." Now, you two both are sitting there right now going like, "Oh, of course, big dummy. That was Kebnerization from his kitty cats." But it just, you know, it he didn't have it anyplace else. It kind of snuck up on me. So he was my very first deucravacitinib patient to put on, and just did amazing and is still doing amazing. You know, one pill a day, with or without food, and I would challenge you to look up in any kind of medication guidelines about, you know, other drug interactions with it. It's the shortest list I've ever seen. And anyway, he's doing great, very happy. His itching went away very quickly. It seems to do better for whatever reason, like I said, in the scalp, and it seems to do better in the hands and feet than some other locations. I don't know why. But it does a great job in those spots. And so he was a scalp psoriasis from the start that I just missed, and he's doing great now.
Well, don't feel bad because scalp can be very tricky. Very kind of like mild psoriasis in the scalp can look like seborrheic dermatitis. I mean, that's stumped me a couple times. Or you get the amazing SIBO psoriasis diagnosis. You're like, okay, I've treated for seb derm and they're not getting better. I guess I'll biopsy, but I know what it's going to come back as. It's going to be SIBO psoriasis. And then what are we going to do? But so Jamie, Kirk just mentioned that it seems to do really well with scalp, but also palmar and plantar. And you've mentioned that too, that that's where you have seen a lot of really good results with it.
Yes, I have. And like I had mentioned before too, when we had discussion, you just can't rule it out. I mean, there are patients that have been on biologic therapy that just I cannot get to clear in certain areas, and they go ahead and put them on deucravacitinib and they clear. That is just amazing. Especially, I shared a story about the lady with her legs, and it's just, she just wanted to be able to share and wear, shave and wear capris and wear a skirt. And she's still clear. She was one of my first patients. So we really, you just don't know until you try.
Yeah. And it's nice
Yep,
to have some medication that you don't have to worry about blood work either. I mean, just checking, you have to screen for tuberculosis beforehand. But if you look at the labs and their clinical trials, there's just no reason. If you're taking care of a psoriasis patient, there's reason to get blood work, right? I usually let their PCP do that. But as far as this drug, as this medication is concerned, I can't find a reason to get any labs at all, other than just like what the FDA recommends or demands, which is screening for TB.
And I have a question just out of curiosity, because I have spoken to some providers that when they screen, I always do lab work on all of my patients. Kirk, in a previous session, I talked about how I'm in a rural area and these patients often don't go to the doctor unless they are just probably on their deathbed. So I typically will go ahead and draw labs, and that helps me to help them. Oh God, I lost my train of thought. I hate it when that happens. Oh, it was going to be so good too. Okay, hold on. Let me remember what I was about to say. Hold on. You just said, oh my God. I'm brain dead.
You know
Okay, what were
what?
you just saying,
I missed the
Kirk?
psori I missed the psoriasis patient. Got I stared at for a couple of years, and it's okay. We have a little
Sugar.
we have yeah, so I was saying there's no reason to get labs based on the drug, on the
Oh, I know what I was
condition.
going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a question for both of you because I have heard several different providers mention that because it just says that you need to screen for tuberculosis, they use the screening questions and look to see if they're a high-risk patient or not. I do blood work. I do QuantiFERON TB Gold just because I'm already doing lab work on all of my psoriasis patients. But how do you guys screen for TB? Erk, you want to go?
Sure. Probably the first week he got FDA approval, I had a guy came in and pretty good psoriasis. And I said, "Hey, do you have any fever, chills, cough, night sweats, losing weight?" Nope. Okay. Have you ever even heard of TB? No. Okay. Well, I might need to do, or we could, or we could not do this tuberculosis test. He's like, "Oh, I've heard of tuberculosis. Really? Yeah. My dad had it and my sister had it. And I had to take some pills a long time." So anyway, long story short, he was positive. So I go ahead and just do due diligence. And as long as I've got a needle in their arm, I'm going to ask them, "Hey, is there anything else that we need to check for?" Because personally, I hate doing blood work. And if I'm having to do anything, let's get everything that I have to get. So I offer that to my patients, but that's the condition, it's the patient, it's not the medication. Just to separate that out.
What about you, Jamie? What do you do?
Oh, I definitely do it all. I really do because, these patients have chronic disease, and I just want to know if I have to switch them down the line, then I'm all set. I can go ahead and do it right then and there. I don't have to send them back to a lab. I have their hepatitis screen done. I have their TB done. I have what I need. And also, I don't like being caught by surprise. We've talked before, and I do not like it when a patient is seen in primary care by somebody else, and they say, "Oh, yeah, you're having that increase in your liver enzymes or that increase in your triglycerides because you're on this medication." So, if I don't do the baseline, I don't really have a leg to stand on.
I
And
agree.
so, I that's what I do. I just dot my I's and cross my T's.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. That's exactly what I do. Just makes me feel better personally. So, I think there's definitely pros to having something that's been out for a while, like apremilast. I think people get comfortable with that drug, or a drug in general that's been out for a while because they know what to expect with it. For the most part, because it's been around. But then I think there's definite pros to evolving and medicine evolving and us having newer options. And that's exactly what has happened. We're evolving and things are getting better. We're able to be more specific with our targeting. We're able to be more efficacious. We're able to be safer, more easier to use because things are now once a day versus twice, or some of the injectables, we're doing now only a few times a year. And so it's been really fun. I've been in dermatology for 16 years, so not quite as long as the two of you, but it's been really fun. Obviously, I love inflammatory skin diseases, but just to see the evolution of everything that we have, even the really cool topicals that are out right now. We look at roflumilast or tapinarof. Those are so cool and how they work. And actually, instead of just suppressing inflammation, we've now got topical therapies that actually affect cytokines. I mean, who would have ever thought that that would ever be something that we would have in our arsenal? So I just think it's super cool. So, Kirk, we'll finish up. Yes.
Lauren, I want to mention one other thing, but
Oh,
even when we
yes.
talk about these topicals, they don't burn and they don't itch. They don't burn and sting for our patients either. All the years of using, trazodone, and it's like these patients were just, burning and stinging so terribly. It's like pouring battery acid on them. We don't have to worry about the striae. We don't have to worry about those things. And not only that, we don't have to worry about it, taking in, making our clothing a mess. It's not greasy. It's not oily. They're made in really nice, cosmetically elegant preparations, so people don't mind putting them on once a day.
A
So
big thing
it's
about my
really good
patient earlier
things.
today was that, his psoriasis in his genitals, and he was concerned, "Okay, if I have this medication, I'm intimate with my partner, and I just was very honest with him, and I could not see a reason that it was going to cause any problem. And that gave this particular individual and me a lot of just relief.
Yeah. And I'm one of those that I never give a patient a topical prescription unless I have felt it myself, because I want to know what it feels like so that I can understand how it's going to feel, obviously, when they apply it. So if they call back or they're having questions or they have complaints, I can say, yeah, it is a little greasy, or yep, it did burn. We're just in such a cool era, you guys. It's kind of like we're in our psoriasis era, like Taylor Swift. Kirk, I know you won't appreciate it, but Jamie, you will. I'm a Swiftie, and so I'm gonna go ahead and just say we're in our psoriasis era. Okay.
Know what? There's still more to come. There
Yeah,
is
there
there's
is.
still some more stuff to come. I was hearing about just recently that it seems really, really good, surprisingly, but really good.
Yep, and bimekizumab that launched and got its approval last fall. That's been a new option. So it's just, yeah, we're in such a cool time. And these younger providers that are in derm, they're never going to understand what it's like
No.
to have to do coal tar and topical triamcinolone. They're just never going to get it, but that's okay. So before we
Our speedy
finish,
four counts with Amivine.
oh my gosh, yes. So before we finish, Kirk, you've been doing this a long time. So what advice do you have for APPs that are, trying to figure out what to prescribe? They think they want to do something systemic. They think the patient is a candidate for systemic therapy. What are some pearls that you could give to them to kind of help them in that process?
Have a good relationship with PCPs around that you can refer somebody to if there's some kind of an issue or a problem. This is such an easy place to start is with deucravacitinib. It really is. As far as efficacy and safety, more people quit placebo in the clinical trials than they did with deucravacitinib. No drug interactions after you have to worry about. So that's a great place to start if we're gonna go down a systemic route. And then I would say I'd get to know my IL-23s and my IL-17s. Some people are going to be more likely to take a medication once a quarter, but then again, there's that same patient that is going to forget because it's only every 3 months instead of just once a day. Just kind of know your patient, read your patient, ask your patient what they prefer. Some people want an injection, they don't want to think about something every day. And some people can't stand to think about actually having to inject themselves. And they're already taking a medication or their vitamin or supplement once a day. And that just throws it right in there and no big deal. So it's a great world, great time to be able to treat psoriasis right now. So we've got some fantastic options out there.
Yeah. Jamie, any last minute pearls that you want to share?
Just remember that your patients are all individuals. None of us, even though between the three of us, look at how many years we've been practicing in derm. Are we going to literally be able to look at a patient and say right away, you're going to respond 100% to this? It's not possible. Every time we see a patient, we hope to hit a home run. Why? Because we want to improve their quality of life. And it's really important. And they say to us, thank you so much. And it's really important because we know all about the comorbidities and everything else, risk of psoriatic arthritis in the eye. But don't be afraid. Educate yourself. Educate your patients. Nobody's 100% 100% of the time. And so we really were just very lucky. Like Kurt says too, the research and development continues on. It's just amazing. And all three of us have seen this. Don't be afraid to help our patients.
Yeah, I think we're going to find a cure. There's going to be a cure in our lifetime. I do. My pearl would be find a mentor. I had one early on that was very well known in the psoriasis space, and he let me just pick his brain, email him questions. He wasn't even my supervising or collaborative physician, but he was somebody that helped me get that love for the disease and helped me along the way. And so I would say find somebody that you respect that will let you, ask questions that you can go to when you want to learn something new or have an issue or need advice on something. I feel really strongly about mentorship. That would be my pearl. So, all right, you guys. Well, we have chatted a bunch, and I kind of feel like we went a little bit around the world, but that's okay. That's why it's fun. So, Kirk, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun. I've been talking to a lot of women, and you're the first guy that we've had on, the first male that I've done in these four sessions. And so, thank you for joining us. And Jamie, always thank you for being my fab co-host.
Thank
And
you.
thanks to the audience for tuning in. And if you liked the content, subscribe to the e-newsletter and you can receive upcoming Medcast episodes and other content in your inbox. So thank you so much for joining us. See you next time.